Hello, I'm Rich Kilgariff. Welcome to Book OMI, original memorable insights, or OMI, from the brightest minds behind the smartest new books in business, science, technology and culture. In this episode...
I'm Bryony Gordon. I'm the author of Glorious Rock Bottom, and this is my OMI for Book OMI.
The columnist and best-selling author shares her OMI on her rise, fall and ongoing recovery from addiction to alcohol.
Every day I felt like the world was ending. You know, there was, towards the end, there was an assault. I just go AWOL, you know, for days. And I'm going to lose everything. Do you know what I mean? I'm going to lose my daughter, certainly my husband, my job, you know, everything that I hold precious. And, you know, I thought that they were the most important things to me, but really the most important thing to me was alcohol. And that still... takes my breath away now to admit it, but it's important I do remember that's where alcoholism takes us.
What happens when relaxation and fun turns to dependency and shame? And if we do hit the lowest low, how do we get back up again? Bryony, welcome to Book OMI.
Thank you for having me. Talking
about booze and drugs a bit early.
It makes me feel, even just thinking about it goes, oh.
In the writing of the book, reliving your journey to and from Glorious Rock Bottom, did you uncover any fresh insights along the way? Because you said earlier that you put off writing the book for a long time, but did you find anything else new along the way writing the book?
I look back, I was reading it out the other week on for my audiobook, and I don't really know how I wrote it, but it just fell out of me. You know, it was like I was in a sort of... In like an inebriated state, so to speak, you know. It's so weird. It's so weird when you write about a subject as personal and you write about things as personal as I have in Glorious Rock Bottom, because when you then come to discussing it in like the promotion, you almost distance yourself from it a bit, which is strange because it's you and it's the stuff you've lived through and survived through. So fresh insights, I don't know. I mean, since getting sober, life has just been like one long series of insights as to who I am, what I am, what I believe, what I like, what I don't like, what I stand for. You know, I don't think I really knew before I got sober. I was so defined by drinking and drugging. So it's like every day is a process of revealing new truths about myself.
The book begins towards the end of your role, as you put it, like a ghost haunting your own life. But to the outside world, it was a life to be envied, you know, good time girl, party girl. Did that make it more difficult for you to face up to your demons at the time because it was easier to go along with the world's version of you?
Yeah, world's version of me makes me sound like I was Madonna or something. I mean, I tell you what was difficult was that I had this view of alcoholics, which is a very stereotypical view that a lot of people have, which was like park bench, drinking out of a paper bag all day, round the clock, lost everything. And I, at the time that I got sober, I had literally just reached probably the absolute height of my career in that I'd managed to secure this interview with Prince Harry about his mental health. My last book, which had been about obsessive compulsive disorder, which I've suffered from since childhood, had just gone to number one in the Sunday Times bestseller charts. You know, it was by any kind of, I was doing well, but I just run a marathon, do you know what I mean? I just raised like 50,000, no, sorry, I think I raised something like £80,000 for a mental health charity. It was like bizarre, you know, it was like everything seemed to be going well. I just founded this mental health peer support group. But I was drinking more and more in the evening and, you know, and going back to old ways that I'd perhaps, you know, I'd really... you know, my 20s was just a blizzard of cocaine, basically. And because it helped me to drink more, you know, it sobered me up and helped me to drink more. And I say in the book, it was like I was trying to balance this like ever impossible list of success with the reality, which was that I was basically trying to kind of self-sabotage and destroy it. And, you know, it was all quite unexpected for me. So I'd written about my obsessive compulsive disorder and my depression. And I hadn't really known that it was going to become the kind of like that people were going to take to it in the way that they did. And then I heard, you know, it was, and I'd always, drinking had always been my way to kind of self-medicate through the intrusive thoughts and the horrors. And of course it had actually made it worse, but all I wanted was to kind of be out of it, be out of my head at that moment. And so how I felt the next day wouldn't come into it, because that I could deal with that then. You know, now was now, and now was awful, and now needed to be obliterated. And so I wrote about that. And it's funny, because it was a kind of time when, well, I became lauded as this sort of mental health campaigner, but all along I was suffering from the very thing that I was campaigning against, you know, the stigma that I was trying to break down, which was that I was too ashamed really to admit to the alcoholism. And I couldn't admit to the alcoholism, because I couldn't put myself as an alcoholic. Like, I was, you know, I was successful, I was earning money, I was, you know, I had a house in Clapham and a baby and a husband, and, you know, it all looked so, how could I be an alcoholic? And I didn't drink every day. I mean, I drank every other day. I didn't drink during the day, you know. I had a list of like quite hard and like very important rules to stick to, which was like, don't drink until after my daughter's gone to bed. So obviously she was put to bed very rushed and hurriedly. And don't drink spirits, don't drink wine, you know. Like, by the end of it I was just drinking session ale, because I could drink more and more and more of it. And, you know, and I thought that all these rules meant I wasn't an alcoholic. And, you know, I felt like sometimes I spent my whole life trying to prove I wasn't an alcoholic. And in the end it was like, it was just going to be easier to surrender to the fact I was, you know, because even though I wasn't drinking all day, I was thinking about drinking all day. Like, it completely structured my life. Like, if I had a big work thing on a Tuesday morning, that would mean I couldn't drink on a Monday night, which meant I had to drink on a Sunday, and so on and so forth. And that may sound like insidious, you know, it may sound like, oh, I don't know, it may sound, I don't know, like quite normal to people. I don't know, but it was, I was just lived in the consequences of my drinking 99% of the time were in my own head. And, you know, the drinking was very much at home in my own garden, you know, by myself towards the end. But, you know, there were things that were happening that were, and I just felt like I was about to be, felt every day I felt like the world was ending. You know, there was, towards the end, there was an assault. I just go AWOL, you know, for days. And I was like, this isn't, I am going to lose everything. Do you know what I mean? I'm going to lose my daughter, you know, certainly my husband, my job, you know, everything that I hold precious. And, you know, I thought that they were the most important things to me, but really the most important thing to me was alcohol. And that still takes my breath away now to admit it, but it's important I do remember that's where alcoholism takes us, you know.
Yeah, it's a control issue as well, isn't it? Because there's a really interesting insight towards the end of the book, actually, when you're talking to Peter, the counsellor, and he advises you about the traits of addicts and alcoholics often are informed by a desire to do too much, to do lots. And actually, it's the oblivion that you seek through drugs to get you away from the insurmountable amount of pressure you're putting on yourself a lot of the time. And so it's easy is the wrong word. The image that we have of the drunk out of it, out of control, is actually not the one that will be familiar to lots of people who skirt around the periphery of alcoholism through our lifestyles, which we've all grown up within that culture, and especially in urban areas. It's part of our culture, isn't it?
I think arguably alcohol is the only thing we're given as children as a coping mechanism. Now, I'm not saying that we were all like made to drink when we were kids. What I'm saying is it's the only thing we see. Like, I don't know about you, but my dad and my mum would get back from work and they'd be like, oh, today was awful, let's have a glass of wine or whatever. There isn't, you know, obviously there is no mental health provision in this country. We don't have any kind of way of, you know, we don't really have any mental health education in schools. So it's not like anyone grows up thinking that it's okay to feel like crap. You know, it's like, we have to get rid of it. You know, happy is the goal. And if you're not happy, you're failing, which of course we know is bollocks. Do you know what I mean? And, you know, alcohol is a depressant, right? It's a depressant that masquerades remarkably well as a relaxant. Like, it's an Oscar winning actor, and we can get into a lot of trouble quite quickly with it. And, you know, I don't want to like spoil the fun of anyone who can have like two drinks you know, and every night, you know, with a dinner or whatever, or who, you know, life is too short. Do you know what I mean? But this is about the people for whom that isn't possible. And, you know, I think it's far more of us than we want to admit, you know, that, you know, that it's not, it doesn't fit society to know that so many people react so badly to alcohol, or they use it so irresponsibly, you know. And like, I say that thinking about the little tags, you know, the little stickers they put on bottles, which are like, drink responsibly. And that adds to the sense of failure and shame, because like, why can't I drink responsibly? Why can't I drink like everyone else? Do you know what I mean? Why is it once I pick up a drink, that's it, I'm off. It's honestly, Richard, easier for me to have none than one. Do you know what I mean? To moderate. That was always my goal. Moderate, if I could just moderate my drinking. And I couldn't. And, you know, I think it's really important we have these conversations, because there's so many of us who suffer because of the shame and stigma of not having them, you know? And not just the people who are suffering from the alcoholism or the addiction, but everyone around them. Do you know what I mean? So for each alcoholic and addict, I don't know, I'm not a scientific researcher, but I would guess at least 10 people are affected negatively by that drinking. And we know that because, as well as having 12-step meetings for people who suffer from alcoholism, there's 12-step meetings for people who are, you know, in relationships with people who suffer from alcoholism. And so it's, you know, it's such a huge issue that we just don't really kind of want to talk about or acknowledge. And we want to put it on the park bench. Do you know what I mean? Where we can sort of walk past it and go, oh my God, you know, that's not me. And it causes, you know, like, alcohol causes a lot of misery for a lot of people, you know, and it causes, you know, a lot of joy as well. Like, I'm not going to lie. Like, I got into it because I loved it. I loved drinking, you know, but in the end, the negatives far outweighed the positives.
Yeah, you look back and you were conditioned when we're growing up, but because of the disinhibition that you feel with alcohol, you know, and also you give it false credence, you give it false kudos, I suppose, for helping you to break the ice when you were younger, or fit in, or chat someone up, or do you know what I mean? And so you grow up evolving your mind and your pleasure centers and your reward centers with knowing that you do this thing, and then you get into life where it becomes something much more of a prop and a depressant, like you say.
Well, Dutch courage, you know, that's always, and you know, and actually I realized that getting sober has made me properly brave, right?
Yeah.
But also, like, there's that notion that alcohol brings out the real person, right? Which is fine if you have one or two and then you're a witty and you're regaling people and everyone's going, gosh, you're wonderful. But if the real quote unquote person that alcohol brings up is someone who's like scrabbling around to get drugs because they want to carry on drinking, and who ends up in all sorts of dangerous positions because of that, be it sexually or, you know, in all sorts of, you know, just puts themselves in vulnerable positions, you know, to think that that's the real you is really hard. And it isn't, you know, like, you know, alcohol doesn't bring out the real me at all. The real me is the person talking to you right now, you know. And I, you know, you see that in treatment with, you know, people, you know, the difference between someone drinking and someone not drinking is huge often. And yeah, so it's, I do think we have an unhealthy relationship as a country with alcohol. I mean, that's not for me to untangle, but you know, this is just me talking about my unhealthy relationship with alcohol. And I hope that one person will read it and see me trying to, and basically that this book is like an act of forgiving myself for the things that happened and the way I behaved while I was in the grips of alcoholism. And it's sort of wanting to give permission to other people to forgive themselves and start that process, you know, of getting better.
Because I mean, only people, and I think a lot more people than anyone cares to admit, will relate to your story, as extreme and as candid and as honest as it is. I mean, only people who've loved and hated drinking and taking drugs in equal measure can describe the experience as you do, the behavior at the bar, even the way you walk up to the bar, the sidestep to the toilet and going in there, and the whole practice. Sorry, I don't want to have a flashback now, but the hyper-engaged fake friend, the hyper-engaged fake friend, you know, the shame of rising, falling and failing time and time. You make it so easy to understand how people can disappear Is that what you want people to feel from the book? I know this is catharsis. I know this is, you've written the book as much for you as for anyone else.
Well, no, but... I don't. You see, that's the thing. I don't write them for myself. I do write them for other people. Because, like, I think about my writing as, like, I write about the things that have made me feel bad about myself to try and help others feel good about themselves. So, like, it horrifies me to think of me 3 years ago, like, not knowing any of this stuff. Do you know what I mean? Like, it breaks my heart to think of the people out there right now, probably across the street from me, or, you know, who are going through this, and they think they're the worst person in the world. I thought I was the worst human in the world. I was the only mum in the world who would blackout drink while her child was in bed upstairs. And there were loads of other things that I don't really want to go, I haven't got, you know, I've gone into in the book, but I don't, you know. And things that I was so ashamed of, so, so ashamed of. And I now realize I'm not a bad person. I was just an ill person who sometimes did bad things because of that illness. And the relief of realizing I wasn't unique, you know, actually I'm one of many, do you know what I mean? The relief of that, I remember going into treatment and starting to go to 12-step meetings, and, oh, it was like balm for my soul. And I, you know, it's interesting because I have written about a couple of incidents that will seem very extreme, do you know what I mean? But they're not. I don't think they are. I think they are much more commonplace than we allow ourselves to admit they are. And so my mum read the book and obviously was horrified. She was like, Bryony, I think that you think that this is more commonplace than it is. And I think people are going to be really, you know, up in arms about it. And I was like, it is more commonplace. It is. It just is. I know it is. I know it is. I know it is from the people I meet who have these problems, the people I hear, the people I, you know, who are in my Instagram messages inbox, you know. And it's like, either it's not that I want to normalize what happens. I don't want to say this is normal, you know, just get on with it. Like, no, I don't want to do that. But what I want to do is try and help people to know that they are not the only people in the world who have been through those shameful things. And there is a way out of it. Do you know what I mean? And when you are at that rock bottom where you can't imagine things can get any better, so you just think, I'm just going to carry on. And they will, you know, and I was kept sick by the shame. Like, I was so appalled by the way I behaved or the things that would happen to me that I would just have to drink to cover it up and create new shames, which sounds bonkers, but, you know, it's really common. And I just, you know, life isn't black and white. We don't live in the Marvel universe, unfortunately, where there's good people and bad people. Do you know what I mean? It's like, we're all a bit of everything. And I think we need to be, I mean, maybe I did write the book for myself to kind of give myself, yeah, of course I write the book for myself. It's like to have more compassion for myself, but also I want other people to have more compassion for themselves or for the people around them who are perhaps in this situation that they can't quite fathom. Like, I know that it's probably very hard if you're the kind of person who can just have one or two. It's just as hard for you to fathom someone who can't as it is for me to fathom someone who can. Do you know what I mean? Like, I don't understand it. And they probably don't understand me. And that's okay.
I suppose it's all a matter of scale, isn't it? And do you remember that? Are you not old enough? Do you remember that? The first reality series was, I think, were called Real World, an MTV series.
I do remember that. Yeah, yeah, yeah. In like San Francisco or somewhere.
Yeah. And there was this group of teenagers living in a house, and their mate got drunk once, had about half a beer, you know, and they were sending them off to get counseling. And as a teen, you know, as a young Brit, you're thinking, oh my God, you know nothing. But yeah. I listened to your podcast with your mum, and it was very moving, actually. Really moving. The way you describe her reading the book then and being sort of horrified and shocked, she was quite candid about it and said, the thing that stuck in my head afterwards was, she said, I thought you were quite good fun when you were drinking. Thought, that's just amazing, isn't it? Even now, knowing what she knows. And you describe putting her through some really worrying moments as a teenager, which I'm sure is pretty common, you know, in terms of teenagers, but especially at Christmas, you seem to choose Christmas as the moment to really let fly. And that's that, these landmark moments in time. And that's why, you know, when you come to recovery, Christmas is almost the biggest hurdle, isn't it? It's the, apart from summer and everyone drinking outside, but.
Well, yeah, I mean, it was probably the biggest hurdle because I'd just come out of rehab. But I guess all year round it was chaotic, all year round, do you know what I mean? But like Christmas was when it would ruin everyone else's experiences. But yeah, I I was quite good fun when I drank, and I was very good at putting that, you know, I was the life and soul of the party, or I was the life of the party. I didn't have much of a soul, you know, and I made a career out of, before we were coming on here, you were saying to the producer, oh, I live my life vicariously through you. And that's what people used to say to me all the time. Do you know what I mean? And they'd be like, oh, Bridie, what have you been up to? And I'd take this like fucking awful incident and I'd like turn it into some fucking stand-up comedy routine, and they'd be howling with laughter. And I was like a performing monkey, and I loved it. I loved it because I could entertain people with stuff that made me feel like shit. And I could pretend it was all normal and it was fine.
I spoke to Elif Shafak yesterday, as you do.
Oh, as you do, yeah. You've gone from the sublime to the ridiculous.
Well, no, because what you're saying and what you say in the book about it's okay to not be okay, in her latest book, How to Stay Sane in an Age of Division, she talks about accepting pain and accepting anger and accepting how it's okay, you know, we don't have to, everything doesn't have to be perfect all the time. And she often talks about having multiple stories. We're all made up ourselves of stories. And your past story is fascinating. And actually, because of your talent as a writer, it's funny. And it's light even in the darkest moments. Do you feel, like we were talking then about you feeling like you were a performing monkey, but you liked it because it gives us a role, doesn't it? It gives us a role in the gang, in the group, when we can make people laugh. Do you feel that you've always felt a pressure to tell your story, to light and dark moments? Is that how you still deal with dark things?
Yes, yeah. I remember when I went into rehab, I'd talk about things that had happened, and then I'd sort of make a joke after them, and the counselors would be like,
yeah.
That's not funny, Bridie. And then I can, and yeah. So, but I do.
But things are funny, though. I mean, that's what.
Well, they are with a bit of distance, not when you're in them. Like, while you're actually in rehab. Do you know what I mean? Like we're here for, you know, alcoholism is serious, and I think it probably is the most serious of my books. I mean, you have to really read to the end for like really. I mean, I try and put, you know, a bit of, but it, you know, it is a night. You know, I do think that. The thing I've learned since getting sober is that I don't have to be happy all the time. It's really fine, you know, and life doesn't owe me happy, you know, and I, you know, some days I'll be in incredible pain, or, you know, I'll be low, or I'll be anxious, and it's horrible, but I sit with it. I am like, I say in the book, I'm like, at first, I was like, getting sober is like having a superpower. And my husband was like, what would your superpower be? And I'm like, sitting with my feelings. And he was like, take that, Thor. Take that, Iron Man. You're going to be a great lot of help in the Avengers. I say that now. It's okay. Like, it's okay to be, when I hear that phrase, it's okay to not be okay, I kind of want to like cringe, because there's so many kind of mental health cliches that have popped up, and I, you know, it's not okay for someone suffering in the depths of alcoholism, and there's a lot of mental illness. You know, we've got a long way to go still. You know, thankfully we're a little bit more understanding about things like depression and anxiety, but we have a huge way to go with lots of other things. And I've kind of gone off topic here, but yes, I love her. I love Elif.
Yeah, she's great, and it has become a bit of a cliche, and you're very so self-aware that you see it as that, but you know, a lot of the time it's because people say those things because they're true. And the great thing about your description of your journey, or you know, and your addiction and your alcoholism, is that it's accessible, it's not boring, you know. That's when people tell you their dream stories, or even your dream stories are really good. Do you know what I mean? It's that there's nothing more boring than someone telling you their drug story. You know,
you
or
think?
Their. Oh my God. Well, it depends what happens as a result of them.
A drunkalogue, yeah.
Yeah, and anyway, because it's a very subjective experience, but because, like you say, being dependent or being drunk or being addicted does affect everyone around you. And it's those human stories that actually you build around your central story here at the beginning. Can we talk about your rehab experience, please? It started as classic circles of chairs. Mm-hmm. Didn't it? But by the way you describe it, perfectly sums up for me how you saw yourself at the time as a piece of shit the world evolves around. I mean, beautifully simple way of describing it. Your words, not mine, by the way.
They're not my words as well. They are someone very close to me in who I met in recovery's words. And every time a piece of shit the world revolves around.
But perfect, a brilliant way to describe someone who is self-centered.
Mm.
Who sees the world through their lens. But also self-hating and self-sabotaging and, you know, self-loathing. It's an incredibly simple way of describing it. And
well, there's so many, I hear these, wonderful, like, honestly, it's so amazing to be sober, to be a sober alcoholic. There's other ways that people much wiser than me who I, you know, meet through fellowship and 12-step programs who say things like, it's like your ego's in the penthouse, but your self-esteem's in the basement. And I'm like, that's another one. It's like, I don't know, it's that paradox, isn't it? I think we all have it sometimes. It's like, I'm an awful person. And then everyone's looking at me. It's like, no one gives a shit. Do you know what I mean? Like, I came in, I remember the day I walked in to rehab and being like, it's like, you know, in the movie, it would be like, I'd stand up and I'd say my piece and everyone in the circle of chairs would be like, oh, well done. You know, you're going to get through this. And in reality, they're all like, yeah, well done. Like, we're all, you know, everyone's here for the same reason. Love, sit down, pipe down, get grounded. Rehab was, I mean, oh, God. I was so lucky to be able to go to rehab. You know, lots of people aren't. You know, it's enabled me to live my life, really. And that was what I said, like, all of us, like, I would never write about anyone else in recovery. That's absolutely not my place. And so it's only about my own experience. But, you know, like my best friend, Holly, who is very happy for me to write about her. And we met when we got into treatment, and she had she has the same sobriety date as me and was living a mile away and has kids the same age and stuff. And is like my sobriety soul sister. But we always joke that, like, the thing we all have in common when we start to get sober is we literally don't have a clue how to cope with life. We're like, life! I remember I was coming up to like a year sober. I started to feel, I cried for about 3 months solid. And it was like, I just realized all of this shit that I'd been like hiding under the carpet. Do you know what I mean? And the carpet had been pulled back, and I was like, I don't want to, you know, the rug had been pulled out from underneath me, and I was like, put it back. And I couldn't see it, unsee it. I'm mixing lots of metaphors here. But anyway, yeah, rehab. That feels
the
like
people, little... the people around you talk about being in the middle and being self-centered. You're very sharply aware of the people around you, even though you're looking at it through a very foggy lens. And is it okay to talk about, well, you talk about him in the book, your husband Harry?
Yeah, we can talk about him. What do you want to know about him?
You're still with him?
Was the last time we checked.
But he, I mean, talk about coming across as a hero. He can't be that nice. I started thinking he was a fictional character.
He always says, he's like, you paint me like some fucking knight in shining armor. Yeah.
But he says, he's not a trained psychotherapist, is he? But he says the thing that the counselors say to you all along, which is, you're not a bad person.
You're an ill person.
Yeah.
I know. Well, it doesn't matter, because I always say to Harry that he's sort of emotionally sort of very, like, we're very different. Do you know what I mean? Like, I'm like, blah, 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 blah. And he's like, you know, the son of an army colonel, all of that. But he's far more versed in dealing with life than I am, you know? And, you know, people always ask this question. I remember when it was the people first reading the book, someone accidentally, like, newspapers were reading it to whether they would serialize it. And someone accidentally forwarded me an email saying, can you ask her why he stayed with her? And I was like, and you'd have to ask him, you know, like, I guess he likes me. He knew it was awful, but I think we've gone through that together, and we've come out the other side. And you know, he knew, it's that thing of like, it hasn't come out of like a clear blue sky that I write books that are kind of revealing and out there. Do you know what I mean? Like, and he, you know, all he cares about is that I'm happy, you know, I'm helping. He's like, if this helps someone else, then great. We don't, you know, I don't do it anymore. Yeah. You know, it hasn't happened for a very, funnily enough, since I got sober.
bizarre that.
But so anyway, a lot of people sober up and discover they're married to assholes. Sobered up and discovered I was the asshole. You know, we have our ups and downs, like all people. And certainly we've had quite a few, given that I got sober. But, you know, this is the reality of life, you know, and we really like each other. I love him. I love him. He's like, he's my person. Like, I can't spend time with other people that often. Him and my daughter are like, you know, they're ace. And, you know, my daughter is the reason, really, that I, you know, not that I would have just carried on with Harry, do you know what I mean? But like, she was the real catalyst for my recovery, because I just couldn't square the two identities. If that makes sense.
It does make sense. And they're a physical reminder of what's good in life. They're before you, they're something that is visceral and physical and manifesting immediately in front of you. And they're the future. That's it, I suppose. They're the future. And you feel like you haven't got a future. And then you see the future and it's one that you could have. So I suppose they're both a wake-up call
it's like the future I want her to have, you know? Yeah, and she's aware that Mummy doesn't drink alcohol and I'm allergic to it. She thinks I've never drunk alcohol. I'm like, no, Edie, I used to drink it quite a lot. She's like, when you were allergic and you drank it, what would happen to you? And I'm like, well, what would happen to me is I'd take all my clothes off and run around naked. And she was like, that's quite funny.
It's funny that, again, we adopt, there's a sort of tacit acceptance of boozing and that sort of fun thing of, you know, you see parents in the pub. We've done it. We've taken our kids to the pub in the past. Ooh, crazy gang. But, you know.
But it's a really common one, actually. And I think that was the thing I could not get my head around. I thought, I will, like, when I got pregnant, I remember thinking, oh, this will, like, it didn't occur to me that I would ever drink again like I did. I used to. I didn't crave alcohol at all while I was pregnant. Had my daughter, probably had a week of like physically being out of it because I'd given birth, and then straight back where I left off. And, you know, and I just couldn't believe it. I was like, how has pregnancy not done for me what rehab does for everyone else? And, you know, and it was quite shocking. And then of course, when something's quite shocking, you have to like bury it under several layers of like Teflon coated denial. Do you know what I mean? And I was like, of course I need a drink. I'm a new mom, you know, and she's and I'm relaxed because of it. And so, you know, and I'm a better parent because of it, you know. And my daughter sleeps through the night. I'm like, she may not, but I was too out of it to know. You know, and it's tragic, but it happens. And I think that it's only when we acknowledge that it happens that we free people and allow people to get better, you know. And either we want to live in a world where, you know, kids aren't affected badly by, you know, children of alcoholics, you know, they're everywhere. And, you know, my daughter is a child of an alcoholic. And the difference between a child's outcome in living with a parent who is an alcoholic in recovery and a parent who is an alcoholic in active addiction is huge. You know, it's huge. And we need to talk about this stuff because it has such a knock-on effect, you know, a huge knock-on effect. And, that's why I'm honest about it. I was, of course, huge amount of shame about it, but I've let that shame go now. I've exposed it to the light, and, you know,
it's like a vampire. Yeah. You can turn it to dust by light.
Yes.
But I've got friends who are recovering alcoholics, and one of them is an ex-editor of a lads magazine. And he was basically, you know, the epitome of the drugs booze bender for almost a decade. And he doesn't seem bothered about being in the company of people drinking. In fact, he sort of quite likes it, oddly. Now, I know everyone's different. How are you around boozers? They can get a bit, I know when I'm out not drinking or sober or whatever, they can get a bit shouty and boring, can't they?
Yeah, I mean, but I don't mind being around people having like a couple of glasses or whatever. Like, I find it actually quite useful because it's a reminder of like why I can't drink. Because I'm like, look at these people drinking normally. And I also just horrifies me. I'm like, oh, that just looks awful. Just awful. Like, I remember at first being like, you're allowed to drink, so just drink properly. So it doesn't bother me. I don't think I'm at a stage yet. I'm 3 years in. I don't think I'm at a stage yet where I wouldn't spend time with people getting out with it. Do you know what I mean? Like, but why would you? Like, it's also not something that a lot of people around me do. So I don't mind it. People are very sweet and they're like, oh, do you mind if I drink? And I'm like, no, of course not. Go for it. But, you know, I do tend to leave when they start to repeat themselves. But I repeat myself and I'm sober. I probably repeated myself 18 times during this podcast, you know.
So. I know, but you haven't leant in on me and jabbed your finger at me.
Oh, God. But we all do that, you know. This is what alcohol does to humans, you know.
It does indeed. But, Bryony, listen, I love spending time with you in your beautiful book. And today, thank you for writing it. Thank you for being you with all your multiple stories, your multitudes, and sharing your OMI today. Thank you, Bryony Gordon.
Thank you so much, Richard.
Bryony's book, Glorious Rock Bottom, is available to buy now in the Book OMI shop. Just follow the link in the description of the podcast. If you'd like to be the first to hear and meet the brightest mind behind the smartest new nonfiction before anyone else, sign up to our monthly most wanted email at bookomi.com. Meanwhile, if you enjoyed this Book OMI pod, please let us know by following or subscribing on your platform of choice. I'm Rich Kilgariff. Stay safe, stay optimistic, and remember, change starts with you. Bye for now.
I love Book OMI.